which are timely this year, this month, or this day. First of all, we are here to observe that the cornerstone, originally laid July 4th, 1915, the first physical evidence of the university, is back where it belongs, in latitude and longitude, if not in elevation. Secondly, today, September 13, 1962, marks the 40th anniversary of the dedication of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. Thirdly, this year, 1962, is the centennial of Land Grant College, and we are the 68th and last of these uniquely American universities. Fourthly, the Alumni Association is presenting a plaque commemorating James Wickersham's efforts in founding the university. How we can cover all of these facets in 1/2 hour, I don't know, but we will try. And I would like at this time to present the president of the university, Dr. William Ransom Wood. Dr. Wood.
Mr. Cashin, on this commemorative occasion, it is a distinct honor and a privilege to be able to introduce to you a member of the first board of regents of what is now the University of Alaska, Mr. Bloom, who is here. And a member of the first student group to enroll at the university, Mr. Ted Loftus. And to make this combination complete, a member of the first faculty of the University of Alaska. This man was first mentioned in the minutes of the Board of Regents on March 22, 1922, when a copy of the then President Bunnell's telegram to him was read into the minutes. The telegram which praises the member of the faculty, of the first faculty I'll introduce in just a moment, very highly indeed. The praise was fully warranted. Not only was this man a member of the first faculty of six, he also became the first dean of the first college to be established as a part of his university, and he later became dean of the college itself, and president of the University of Alaska, its third president, Dr. Ernest N. Patty, our beloved president emeritus, who is here today on this occasion and will tell us something of the 40 years of background of the university. Dr. Patty.
Thank you, Dr. Wood. Members of the Board of Regents, the pioneers of Alaska. I see some freshmen over there, the class, the new class. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a wonderful thing to be back here to meet so many old friends and in such pleasant surroundings where Miss Patty and I spent so many years, happy years of our lives. Once upon a time, so the tale goes, there was a sort of a homespun Turkish philosopher who was taking an afternoon nap, and he dreamed that he was eating a wonderful, delicious plate of soup. Just then, his dream was interrupted by his neighbor shaking him and saying, "My mother is ill, and she said she would like to have some soup if you made it today." This philosopher exclaimed, "What sharp noses these people have! They even smell my dreams." When some 47 years ago, Judge and Mrs. Wickersham, Mrs. Luther Hess, Reverend Hope Lumpkin, and Mr. J.H. Grove drove up on this hill and left their car over there and fought their way through the brush to this spot. They were seeking for a cornerstone, to a site for a cornerstone for an embryo university. When they reached this site overlooking the valley, they decided this would be a good place. And so, as has been recorded many times, Mrs. Hess tied her handkerchief to a bush here. And then they went back to their car and returned to town with this white handkerchief lonely waving in the breeze to give the first substance to their dream of a University of Alaska. Here in their minds, the youth of Alaska would be trained. Here would be a center for the cultural, economic, and scientific pulse of this great frontier country. Yes, they had a dream, but it was so nebulous that I don't think many people smelled it. The cornerstone was formed, and since there were no other funds available, it was paid for out of pocket. On July 4th, 1915, Grand Master John J. Buckley, acting for Tananaw Lodge No. 162, Free and Accepted Masons, was Master of Ceremonies, and Judge James Wickersham, then a delegate to Congress, delivered the address dedicating this cornerstone. Even Judge Wickersham, with his keen imagination, could not possibly have guessed that this brush-covered hill would be transformed into one of the most beautiful areas in Alaska, with its roadways, lawns, and flowers, and that this cornerstone would be guarded by beautiful modern buildings, and that by 1962, more than 1,200 students would be in residence here. Among these may be many of the future leaders of Alaska. I doubt if any who attended the original dedication had smelled the dream. No doubt many skeptics went away with the thought that this block of concrete here would remain hidden in the brush as a stumbling block for the moose. In 1917, the territory legislature appropriated $60,000 for the erection of the first building. This frame building was built about 50 feet behind this cornerstone. The legislature didn't, however, appropriate any money for the operation of the university, for the college. The building was erected, and for 4 years it stood here on this hill, stark and empty. In 1921, the legislature appropriated $41,000. $41,000 wouldn't go very far today, to equip and operate the college. September 13th, 1922 was an eventful day. The Alaska Agriculture College and School of Mines was going to open for business. That morning, we were all in overhauls, working feverishly to get ready for the dedication. That was 40 years ago. A flagpole had been cut. It was to be erected at the cornerstone, but it was not yet in place. All of the male members of the faculty and the president were on the roof of this building, tugging at a rope to aid the ground crew in getting the pole into a vertical position. Now I'm going to take just a second to read an editorial by our very colorful old newspaper editor here, W.F. Thompson, discussing this flagpole. This was on September 11th, just 2 days before the opening of the University of College. He said, this is quoting Editor Thompson. Now I ask you, how can a fellow run up a flag when he has no flagpole? The college has no flagpole and no money to buy one. They got to have a flagpole. M.D. Snodgrass knows where there's a flagpole. We didn't ask him where it is, for it's none of our business. If a fellow has a flagpole and hasn't enough interest to day herd and night herd it, he ought to lose it. M.D. Snodgrass offered to go out before daylight this morning and snare it. Is that right? It must be painted before it can be put up. Some color to prevent the owner from knowing that it's his flagpole. President Bunnell knows whether some feller who has left half a can of white paint and a paintbrush. Then we are shorthanded for raising the pole. So I promise, if necessary, to go to Bert Stevens, then the United States Marshal, and borrow a murderer and a couple of bootleggers from his boarding house, the jail, of course, across the street. I'll tell you, we had colorful editors in those days. Well, anyway, a platform had been erected in front of the building, and that afternoon the procession emerged from the building and took seats on the platform. Governor Bone and Carl Field to represent the territory, Colonel Mears, general manager of the New Alaska Railroad, the Board of Trustees, Morton Stevens, This is Luther Hess, M.D. Snodgrass, J.A. McIntosh, Robert Bloom, who's here today, R.K. Lavery, A.J. Nordell, and P.J. Ricketts. To those, many of you will seem just strange names, but they were some of the very early pioneers and leaders in this area at that time. Then Dr. Vanel, followed by his faculty of six, Clinton Morgan, Agriculture, Earl Pilgrim, Mining Engineering, Miss Elizabeth Kirkpatrick, Home Economics, Herbert Bruce, Chemistry and Physics, Archie Truesdell, Civil Engineering, and myself. I believe Miss Burrell, the President's Secretary, was also on the platform. We had managed to corral six students: Dorothy Ross, Ethel Bailey, Roden Davis, Donald Morgan, Arthur Loftus, brother of Ted. Ted came in a few days later, and Earl Foster. The faculty was young. We were mostly in our 20s and with limited teaching experience. That was well, for it required the optimism of youth to catch the scent of the dream which Dr. Bunnell was handing down to us. To him, this dream was a heady stimulant that was to encompass the remainder of his life's work. W.F. Thompson, the colorful editor of the Fairbanks News Miner, caught a bit of this dream, and for a few days before the opening, his paper was prodded with editorial, suggesting that the college could be a great deal for Fairbanks and for Alaska. He was organizing a caravan of cars to drive out from Fairbanks so we would have a crowd out here. I hope I quote him correctly, but I do remember that he said that if necessary, he would tie a big sash around his belly and lead the parade. He even grew lyrical with his own prose and prophesied that within a few years, this dusty road between Fairbanks and college would be lined with homes, and that there would be lawns and flowers and children playing out in front of these homes. Another of W.F.'s pipe dreams, or so we thought. When Reverend Frederick G. Shearer of the Presbyterian Church arose to give the invocation, he spoke of the great mountain peaks on the skyline. We didn't have the building block him off at that time. Of the tumbling glaciers, he asked God to permit this new institution to rise as a challenge to these mountains and to bring great things to Alaska. We certainly needed God's help. The captains and the kings departed. Also, the 200 or so people from Fairbanks who stood there in the clearing, who stood right here in the clearing in front of this building, and it was just about this same sort of a day, same sort of a chill day. It had been raining. In fact, I have to conclude that in 40 years, the climate hasn't changed very much up here. The president, the faculty of six, and the six students filed back into the shell of a building which signified the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. Except for a few desks and chairs, the building was almost empty of furniture. We had taken packing boxes and put boards across them for tables. A few hundred books comprised the library. I think our library now numbers about 70,000 books. You know, when I think about it today, it frightens me. What right did we have to believe that we could make this dream come true? There were many dark days ahead. There were critical days when it looked as though the college would close its doors and the dream would be extinguished. In fact, sometimes from hour to hour, we didn't know whether the college would go ahead. The indomitable will of Dr. Bunnell and a few other men and women who had smelled the dream kept the college alive. When in 1935 the college became the University of Alaska, it seemed as though our dreams were secure. We did not then sense the Second World War, which would strip our campus of young men. Dr. Bunnell seemed indestructible, but finally the years of hard work took their toll, and his health and energy were impaired. For some years, the university became static, and there was talk that the university could never flourish in its present setting, and that it would either be closed or should move to some other area. The very vitality of Alaska, the wisdom of the Board of Regents and the legislature, plus the devotion of a dedicated staff on campus, quickly crushed this defeatism, and the university entered into a new era of development which left no doubt of its great future. Today, under the leadership of Dr. Wood and his excellent faculty and staff, the university is vibrant, and its place in the academic and research sun seems fully assured. At this instant, If a cosmonaut from another planet is circling in his spaceship above us, he could be reporting that at the northern tip of the continent, he had just sighted a strange tribe of people worshiping around a rectangular stone. We are not like the Muslims at Mecca worshiping the Kaaba. We are rededicating this cornerstone because even in its muteness, it bears witness to the great dreams of those who conceived and nurtured this university. We can now be certain that this campus is one of the most important assets of Alaska. Our imaginations are so circumscribed that we cannot envision the great development which will take place here before 2023, 100 years, with the opening of the university and the college. The great accomplishments that will be made by students who have worked here, the scientific discoveries that will be made here by savants of the university, plus the cultural richness which this university is now giving to its students and to the great state of Alaska. Man is now exploring a vast unknown area in outer space, seeking for his first real glimpse of the universe. He has won for his use, or for his destruction, the unfathomable power of the atom. Through the advances of medical science, his lifespan has been increased about one-third. We have more leisure, though I must admit we haven't learned to use it fully for the proper enrichment of our lives. Agriculture has been revolutionized, and in our country, we have more food than we can eat. Man, in his plodding way, will eventually eliminate hunger. The luxuries that are commonplace to us today were undreamed of by our parents. We are living in the most exciting era of the world's history. Most of these advances are the direct result of the thinking, the work, and the discoveries of university-trained people. When the cornerstone was dedicated here in 1915, the great revolution of discovery had not blossomed. At that time, many doubted the effectiveness of a university education. And I must admit that at times you had to be half apologetic when people found out you were a college professor. Yet there were a few far-sighted men who recognized that our towns and cities should be built around our schools. Fortunately, there were a handful of these men and women on our northern frontier. They had a dream of a university for our great land. Today, their dream has form and substance. It is alive and walking forward with firm strides. You know, there's a song of yesterday that I remember. It went something like this. Have you ever seen a dream walking? Well, I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Patty. I know that I speak for the alumni, for the pioneers, and for the faculty when I thank you for accepting the invitation to be our featured speaker today. Your presence and the message have made this a significant occasion indeed. As Dr. Patty has mentioned, when the college opened in 1922, there were 6 students, 5 of them recent graduates of Fairbanks High School, and a stranger, our first outside student, from Tomahawk, Wisconsin. The next day or so, another Fairbanks student, Jack Hostler, enrolled, and then on the 28th, 2 more students enrolled from Tomahawk. They were Jewel and Ted Loftus, brothers of matriculant number 5, and Ted, who's here with us today, graduated in 1927, and is here to represent the Alumni Association. Ted Loftus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen. After listening to Dr. Patty reminisce about what has happened in the past 40 years, I can hardly contain myself to give you a student's eye view of those same 40 years. They're just every bit as interesting. That's not my job today. I'm here to tell you how pleased I am to see the original cornerstone back in its old location. Had it been mislaid or lost during this period of construction, we might have lost the first traces of the early history of our alma mater. To our founding fathers, it was the hope for the future. To we students, it was an excellent place on a warm day to eat your lunch. It was the center almost of all college social life during a number of years. And probably fills the hearts of at least the older graduates, and is probably and is most likely the thing that will remain in their hearts and their memories as that part of the university that means the most to them. Expanding facilities and honors that are heaped upon this university and will be won't mean half as much as the romances that budded around this same stone and the trouble the engineering students had finding their way back to the benchmark that sits in the very center of it. The Alumni Association, realizing that as time goes on, much of our history is lost, have chosen to present a plaque so that the average occasional visitor will have some notion of the history and just what this piece of concrete means. And we've chosen to place on this plaque the words of the Honorable James Wickersham, who on July 4th, 1915, in his original dedicatory address, made the following remark, and I quote, We who are gathered here today do most solemnly dedicate these grounds and this cornerstone to the everlasting support of the principles of free government, free speech, free schools, for which our forefathers fought, unquote. And in addition to this, we have also added a historical sketch. This cornerstone was constructed by volunteer citizens and Judge James Wickersham, delegate to Congress from Alaska, for the purpose of arousing public interest in the establishment of a land-grant college in Alaska. The cornerstone was a symbol of hope and inspiration for Alaskans interested in higher education, and its very presence aided in rallying popular support. The 1917 legislature created the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines, which opened on September 18, 1922. The University of Alaska, its successor, was established July 1, 1935. Removed temporarily in 1956 to allow for new campus construction and landscaping, this cornerstone of the university was restored to its original site by the University of Alaska Alumni Association in 1962. Mr. Elmer Rasmussen, President of the Board of Regents, I wish and have the extreme honor of presenting this plaque to you and to the University of Alaska from the Alumni Association of the University of Alaska.
Last man who talks on a program when it was told that this has got to be short. That when I heard Dr. Patty give his remarks that were so well chosen and appropriate for the occasion, I was wondering how he was going to bring in that old popular song. And I'm reminded of the second line after the one that he repeated, and that was, "Have you ever seen a dream talking?" Well, I did. And I think but that's what we heard today. We heard some of the dreams of the past talking because they're going to give us the guidance for the future. Now, Mr. Loftus, may I say that while a university exists primarily for its students, a university can be really judged by its graduates. And our university is blessed in having an alumni body that is loyal of heart, active in deed, and courageous in vision. It will be appropriate for all time to come that this plaque will be here to commemorate the beginning of our university and the fine hand which will guard and develop its destiny. So therefore, on behalf of the official family of the university, I am happy to accept this plaque from all the alumni of the university as a permanent and tangible evidence of the faith of the past and the dreams for the future.
Thank you, Mr. Rasmussen, for very kind words. And in closing, I would like to acknowledge perhaps the one person most responsible for the alumni plaque. I'm referring to Mrs. Ted Loftus, better known as Audrey, who was Executive Secretary of the Alumni Association for the past 5 years, and was the guiding light, I think, in the planning and making arrangements for the restoration of the cornerstone. I'd like to have a little applause here for Audrey Loftus. I'd like also to acknowledge the fine work of the new Executive Secretary, Mrs. Betty Harrop, and co-chairman of the committee in charge of today's arrangement, and to committee members Margaret Hornbeck, Colonel Byers, and Major Orr. Also the fine cooperation of the Buildings and Grounds crew, the Engineer's Office, Ben Atkinson, and George Knight. Now, there are many I could mention, but time does not permit. So, to close the program, we will have our official state anthem, Alaska's Flag, sung by Miss Robin Busby, class 1958.
Those concerning the present arrangement of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. These criticisms apparently are generated by the fact that the Joint Chiefs of Staff do not come to a unanimous agreement on all problems that face them.
I would like to point out that such a situation among any body of men is not unusual. The Supreme Court often arrives at a split decision resulting in a majority and a minority report. Certainly the Congress must not display a unanimous view on bills and other matters submitted to it. Despite all this, it is interesting to note that the efforts of the Supreme Court are referred to as deliberations. When the Congress thrashes out an issue, it is debating. But when the Joint Chiefs of Staff consider their problems and fail in unanimous agreement, they are accused of bickering. Although I have been a regular member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for only a month, I have long been a participant in its operation. I can assure you that although we do have differences of opinion, which must be expected even among reasonable men who are examining difficult and complex military problems, these differences are relatively infrequent. Moreover, we have a most effective means of settling them in the person of Secretary of Defense, who makes the decision in the event of conflicting views. I might add that Secretary Gates, drawing on his long experience in the Department of Defense, has been especially effective in his understanding and decision on controversial issues. Actually, the number of matters on which the Joint Chiefs of Staff are in agreement far outnumber those on which they are unable to agree. Nevertheless, it has been suggested that the Joint Chiefs of Staff be abolished and a single Chief of Staff substituted in their stead. In my opinion, this is not the proper solution for several reasons. First, under the American system of government, this single Chief of Staff would still not have the power of final decision. Under the terms of our Constitution, this power is vested in the President, and under the National Security Act, in the Secretary of Defense, both of whom would be superior to the single Chief of Staff. Furthermore, since the President or the Secretary of Defense must make a final decision, it seems reasonable to me they should have the benefit of the considered judgment of the chiefs of each of the military services, or in Supreme Court language, they should have the benefit of both the majority and the minority opinion. At this point, it may seem to you that as the Army's new Chief of Staff, I am devoting a great deal of my remarks to matters outside the Army's purview. I have done so intentionally, not only because I am representing the Secretary of Defense, but also because activities involving the Department of Defense and our allies consume a great deal of my time and the time of the Army staff. However, I would like now to indulge in one or two purely parochial comments. My first comment concerns the condition of our Army forces. In my opinion, the Army we have today is a superb fighting force which would give a superior account of itself in battle. Its people especially are of the highest caliber. Our major deployments worldwide consist of 5 divisions in Europe, 2 in the Far East, 1 in Hawaii, and 6 in the United States. We have 2 battle groups in Panama, 1 in Okinawa, and as you know, 2 here in Alaska. We also have the Southern European Task Force in Italy. All of our units, except those stationed in the original 48 states, are under the operational control of unified commanders. As you know, General Armstrong is the unified commander for Alaska, commands not only the Air Force, but all of the Naval and Army units here as well. Now, to be effective, an Army must be able to shoot, to move, and to communicate. To provide the most modern means to accomplish these objectives, we look to our Army's vigorous research and development program. I feel that in the Army, our machinery for research and development, as recently reorganized, is highly effective. The ultimate problem, of course, is to place in the hands of troops adequate amounts of weapons and equipment, which results from our research and development program. Among Army weapons in the research and development stage, none is more important than the Nike Zeus, our anti-missile missile. The feat of intercepting an intercontinental ballistic missile with a killer missile has been likened to hitting a bullet with another bullet. No one underestimates the difficulty of solving that problem. Meanwhile, the important thing is that the problem must be solved, and further, it must be solved before the Soviets themselves produce a means of defending against long-range missiles. Otherwise, we would stand naked to a Soviet missile attack while he was protected against our retaliation. We feel that the Nike Zoo system, the only anti-missile system with components actually in the hardware stage, shows increasing promise and success with every passing month. Moreover, we have already demonstrated that a supersonic missile like the Nike Hercules can be intercepted and destroyed by another Nike Hercules. In other words, difficult though it sounds, a bullet can hit another bullet. In its continuous quest to improve our capability to fight on the ground, the Army overlooked no steps in its research and development program. That is why we are very much interested in space development. Earth satellites such as the Courier have tremendous potential in helping us to improve our long-range communications. Satellites have already permitted us to make major advances in geodesy and mapping performed by the Army Corps of Engineers. The use of reconnaissance satellites and those giving early warning of enemy attacks have obvious value to the Army as well as the other services. At this point, I cannot predict the time when men will fight each other in the medium of space, but right now it can be used to great advantage in improving our capability to perform our missions here on Earth. In concluding my remarks today, I'd like to remind you that the military forces, Army, Navy, Air Force, that we have stationed here in Alaska are among our best. The quality of these forces reflects the splendid leadership of Lieutenant General Armstrong, the theater commander, Rear Admiral Caldwell of the Navy, Major General Nickerson of the Air Force, and the Army's General Michaelis, who sits by me. I wish I had more time to visit with these commanders and their units, but unfortunately, the short notice I received for this trip did not permit me to plan on doing so. Although this is the first time I have visited Alaska, I have served recently in Korea and before that in Europe. Such service has afforded me the opportunity to observe not only our Army troops overseas, but also the members of our other armed services and our allies. From my observations, all these young men and women, often serving far from home, are performing their duties in superb fashion. Their morale is high, despite long hours and hardships, because they have a sense of purpose and mission. They know that upon them rests the defense of the free world. To me, these soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines symbolize the vigor and will which free men throughout history have displayed in their resistance to tyranny. Their devotion to duty and to country augurs well for the outcome of the great contest against communism in which we are now engaged. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, General Decker. I truly believe that that is the highlight of this meeting. I sat here very inspired. Ladies and gentlemen, we now proceed to our order of business. General Decker will forgive us for sticking that in here, and I'd like to give another announcement that we're going to meet over in Bunnell Hall, as Don Dickey stated. There are many ladies here at the lunch today. I assure you, if you want to come over, you'll find it interesting. The transportation will be provided throughout the afternoon, I'm quite sure, I hope so, at the end of the deliberations over there, at least. I know that for a fact. I might ask Art, do you know something about the transportation now in case people want to return to town? We'll now go over to Bunnell Hall, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming.
I'm very excited. My brother is a